Roger Harms. They had a chance to talk to you people a couple times earlier this week, but for the tape, I'm Roger Harms. I'm an obstetrician from Rochester, Minnesota. With me today is John Sandy, who's a medical student at Mayo Medical School and also recently a Pew Scholar at the University of Chicago in medical ethics to be started in September. So, our topic for today, we provocatively titled, "Are Doctors Telling You the Truth?" And admittedly, that title was to get people here. but I think that you will see as we go through this that there, I think that the title does represent what we're going to be talking about. It's a continuation of our brief study that we've had this week on medical ethics questions. We've hit a few highlights, I guess you could say. Certainly not a broad understanding of the field. But I'm going to let John start things out here with a little bit of an introduction about ethics in medicine.
Thanks, Roger. Many of you are wondering how medical students happen at vacation. All you have to do is have a good friend who's chairman of the medical school course in obstetrics. just by way of background, just so you kind of know where I'm coming from, I was born in Fargo, North Dakota, raised mostly in Rochester, and been a longtime resident there, went to St. Olaf College. After St. Olaf, spent some time working in the lab at the clinic. And then after about 3 years of doing that, I was accepted into medical school. And at that point, I had a couple other career choices, including going into the seminary or going into healthcare administration. And I think the big reason I chose Mayo was my wife-to-be was still in Rochester at that time. So far, I've been happy with that decision. And recently, recently I've become more interested in medical ethical issues for a variety of reasons. First I want to offer a couple reflections as a third year medical student, for whatever that's worth. And then I want to put our question, as we've stated it, do doctors tell you the truth, into a framework so you can have an idea of what some of the bigger issues are in medical ethics. I guess I want to offer one observation about medicine, and that is that it's kind of a peculiar profession. It's kind of strange. What I mean by that can be explained by this line on the top here. Science on the right and humanities on the left, and with the arrows going both ways. And in medicine, you kind of shift each second between those two things. You go back and forth between the science and humanities. Science part of it is coming up with the diagnosis and the treatment and watching the treatment and monitoring the course of your treatment and using all those tools that we're all so familiar with to monitor how you're doing. The humanities part of it is obtaining the history from the patient, using that information to relate to the patient and reacting to situations you get into and dealing with people. And in my short experience in medicine, I've seen the practice of theology, practice of philosophy, sociology, psychology, economics, all in the clinic rooms, some of it better than others, but I've seen it all. And so I think medicine is really an art, balancing the practice of science and the practice of humanities at the same time. And as far as the education process in medicine, the profession does a pretty good job of educating people in the science parts of it. But in my opinion, they do an abysmal job of educating people in the humanities aspect of it. Most people learn their humanities part of medicine by observation and by example. And if you're observant and sensitive and thoughtful, it's a really rich experience. I could tell you a lot of really funny and humorous and rich stories about the experiences I've had following consultants around at the clinic and watching their interactions with patients. But I'm not sure that that's the best way to learn, nor is it the most effective way to learn, because I think the humanities part of medicine is probably the most important. And I think that the practice of medical ethics fits into the humanities area of medicine. And it's an area where, again, in my opinion, many physicians fear to tread. They don't like to talk about ethical issues. And a lot of reasons for that I could think of. Their education hasn't been directed much to the humanities. The career rewards in medicine are much more fit into the pursuit of the science aspect of medicine. I mean, understanding disease, coming up with new treatments of disease, that's where all the career rewards have been in medicine in the past and continue to be now. And that fits more into the science side of it. There's also the time aspect. If many of you have been attending Ron Marshall's Kierkegaard sessions, you know how much time has to be spent trying to understand philosophers and theologians. And physicians don't really have time to sit and beat their heads against walls trying to understand people like Kierkegaard, even if they want to. Also, ethics can be a really vague area. I mean, oftentimes there aren't any right answers, and you end up weighing options, and you don't really know which way to choose. And physicians don't like that. They like to have quick, fast answers where they know what they're doing is right, or at least, you know, have a reasonable chance of being right. And sad to say, another reason that we don't talk about ethics much is it's not really recognized as an important area, or it hasn't been in the past. It's becoming more so. There are only a handful of areas in the country where they deal a lot with biomedical ethics from the medicine perspective. There's a man down in Baylor in Texas. There's somebody in Tennessee. There's a guy at Georgetown in Washington, D.C. The Hastings Center in upstate New York deals a lot with it. A couple people in Minneapolis, and then down at the University of Chicago, where I'll be for the next couple of years. But other than that, there are not a lot of people dealing with those issues, although they're becoming more and more important. In that, what that means to me is that the medical profession is not necessarily any more well-trained than any of the rest of us in making ethical decisions, which is pretty scary, because I don't think many of us are very well-trained at all. And so what ends up happening, you could see that with the session we had with Charles Lutz earlier this week, where we were discussing in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination by donors. The people that write about these issues are often theologians or philosophers, and they write from their perspective, which is very good. But they often don't have the technological understanding of the procedures that you need to make that extra push to really get a conclusive answer to some of the problems. And so a lot of these issues end up falling through the cracks. And another thing that I found is that those people in medicine that are sensitive and are concerned about the issues that they deal with on an everyday basis as far as ethical concerns go, they end up feeling really isolated because they don't really know how to make their decisions. And they're searching for ways, and that it's really important to them to know, but a lot of their colleagues don't really care about it. And so if you're really concerned about what you're doing, you don't really have anybody to discuss it with. And the church hasn't been very good in being a resource for those kinds of people. So you end up kind of trying to steer a middle ground between feeling good about what you're doing and not wanting to offend any of your colleagues. And I'm sure Roger could speak more to that if we gave him a chance. So what I've done here on the board, it just made a list of some of the classical biomedical ethical issues that people have written about in the past. And there are a few more than this, but this hits most of the classical ones. And one we're going to talk about right here is part of the doctor-patient relationship issue. And there are several models for that. One is the engineer model. That's where the patient walks into the doctor's office and says, "I don't know what's wrong with me. You tell me what to do and I'll do it. I don't want to think about what's wrong. You just tell me what to do." The priestly model is a little bit less one-sided than that. That's, you know, as a priest would deal with the parishioner, kind of giving advice and suggestions and trying to get the patient to understand. Contractual model is probably the most popular right now, and that's where basically the patient and the doctor enter into a kind of contract, and they both have obligations and responsibilities to each other. And very involved in all those models is the issues of autonomy, paternalism. Autonomy is the idea that the patient has most of the input and most of the control over what is done to him. Paternalism is the other side of that issue, where the doctor has most of the input and most of the control. And people are seeking to balance those two out and trying to work on which one is most important. Another part of the doctor-patient relationship is truth-telling, which is what we'll be modeling today. Another part of that is confidentiality. Other issues that people have talked about are informed consent, competence as far as the physician goes, primum non nocere, which is really
don't do any harm as far as the doctor goes. If you don't know what you're doing, at least don't harm the patient by doing something you don't know what's going to happen to the patient. Killing versus letting die, I mean, that's a big issue recently. Distributive justice issues, that hasn't been talked about a lot in medicine, but, you know, we spend a lot of money in the United States on a lot of high technology stuff that's useful for us, but that money might be better used in third world nations and more efficiently used. Living wells is a big issue today. The use of new technology is a big issue. And who should participate in ethical decisions is also a big issue. So all those things are things that haven't talked about in the biomedical ethical literature. And today we're just going to concentrate on this one small part of it. And we're going to concentrate on obstetrics issues because that's what Roger's specialty is. But later on, if we come across issues or you have concerns that you'd like to talk about, we can try and address those.
Thanks. Yes, I have sort of a one-sided view here. But John pointed out a number of points that I think that you have picked up from me also over these past few days, that physicians don't have any special training in ethics. And I look to you people as members of the body of Christ to try to give me some input, which I usually don't get from anyone, about the practice of the ethical issues of medicine. I know the science. But where the ethical decisions are made are really in the patient's lap and in the patient's doctor's lap. Very few people would argue that the patient has a very significant thing to say about the ethical decision that arises. However, I hope here we'll illustrate a little bit about how the doctor influences that. We're going to do that through discussing a case, and the case is the same. I want you to try to listen carefully. The patient who we're discussing is the same, but you're going to hear two physician responses and patient responses. So first of all, the background of our patient. Mrs. G.W. is a 36-year-old Gravida 3 para 2, which means that she's been pregnant three times now and has two previous children, with a last menstrual period which began April the 10th, 1986. The pregnancy was planned, the patient having stopped contraception 5 months ago. Her periods have been regular until now, and she has experienced mild nausea since early June. She does not smoke, has not had no alcohol since attempting pregnancy, and has no family history of genetic disease or congenital abnormalities. Mrs. W's past obstetrical history has been uncomplicated, with two normal pregnancies followed by two normal spontaneous vaginal deliveries at term. Her last delivery was 4 years ago. Her past medical history, surgical history, social history, and review systems, these are all things we go through, are negative, okay? Her physical examination reveals the uterus to be enlarged and palpable just above the pubic bone here on abdominal examination, and on pelvic exam confirms that the uterus is appropriately enlarged for dates. The remainder of the physical examination is normal. So this is the part that you go through first. The patient comes back, having gotten dressed again, to sit down and talk. Okay, we have physician number one who's now talking. Congratulations, Mrs. White. Everything looks normal, and you would appear to be well on your way to a nice, normal pregnancy. Your examination is normal, your dates are solid, and it feels like only one. We'll plan to see you as frequently as in your previous pregnancies and ask you to once again take some iron and vitamin supplementations. There is one thing that we do have to talk about this time that we haven't previously. I hesitate to mention it, as I don't want you to worry in the least about it. I need to let you know, however, that simply because of your age, and for no other reason, there is a slightly higher chance of some chromosomal abnormalities in this baby. The most common of these abnormalities is Down syndrome, or trisomy 21. This is a condition in which the baby has an extra chromosome, an extra number 21. Babies with this condition are mentally retarded, but often not profoundly so. They have recognizable physical characteristics, but are certainly not deformed, and most parents of Down's babies who raise them in their home report them to be loving, gentle individuals. The chance of your having a baby with Down syndrome is less than 1 in 150. that is more of a risk than with your last baby, but you were at greater risk then than you were with your first. The risk increases with age. The only reason I even mention this now is that there is a procedure called genetic amniocentesis, which could diagnose this condition well before this baby is born. Some people would choose to have this procedure done early in gestation so that the pregnancy could be aborted. Genetic amniocentesis is a test in which a needle is passed through your abdominal wall and into the uterus, and fluid is drawn from the amniotic sac around the baby. The baby's cells, which are floating in this fluid, can be tested for chromosome number. The test does not detect all genetic or congenital abnormalities by any means, and it does have risk. The risk of the test, that the test itself will cause a miscarriage, is small but real. There have been reports of a baby being injured by the needle insertion, but that has happened less frequently now that we use ultrasound to guide the procedure. The only reason that I mention this now is that the risk of the procedure is somewhat less than the risk of a mother over 35 having a baby with a chromosomal abnormality. Do you have any questions? And Mrs. White responds, "You find nothing wrong on your examination today, though." "Absolutely not. You and your pregnancy look as healthy as you could look." Mrs. White says, "My mom was 40 when she had me, and I guess I'm pretty normal." "That's right. The odds are you would have a normal baby even if you were 45, though the risk would be slightly higher." "Well, I'll mention it to Dave tonight, but I don't think I would be interested in such a procedure," says Mrs. White. "That's certainly fine. I'm only informing you about it, not recommending it." That's position number one. Okay. Now, same situation, same patient, same issues. Position number two. "Well, Mrs. White, everything looks fine at this point. The uterus is appropriate size for your dates, and you look perfectly normal on physical examination. As with your last pregnancy, I'd like you to take some iron and vitamin supplementation and continue to avoid alcohol or any other drug, as you have wisely done so far. We'll plan to see you at the same intervals as we have in your previous pregnancies, and I see no reason to expect any problems with labor. There is something else we need to talk about today, though. Since you're over 35, you should probably have a genetic amniocentesis. With increasing maternal age, the chance of having a baby with chromosomal abnormalities is greatly increased. At age 37, which you will be when this pregnancy would come to term, your chance of having a baby with a chromosomal abnormality is about 1 in 170, and that's more than 25 times the risk it was at the age of 20. The most common of these chromosomal abnormalities is trisomy 21, or Down syndrome. You're probably familiar with the appearance of people with this disorder. They usually have kind of a round face with slanting eyes and a prominent tongue. You're also probably aware that these individuals are mentally retarded in every case. In addition, children with Down syndrome often die in childhood with complications of congenital malformations of the heart or the gastrointestinal tract. Many who don't need multiple surgical procedures to repair such problems. The overall life expectancy of patients with Down syndrome is substantially reduced. Other chromosomal abnormalities are also more likely to occur with maternal age greater than 35, and trisomy 13 and 18 are two of the more common. Both of these are universally fatal in infancy. A genetic amniocentesis can detect these abnormalities early in pregnancy, in time to have the pregnancy terminated. A sample of the amniotic fluid is obtained, and cells which are in the fluid can be examined for chromosome content. Any chromosomal abnormality can be detected, as well as some other congenital problems, such as neural tube defects, anencephaly, and spina bifida. Not all congenital abnormalities can be detected by this method, however. There is a small risk of infection or rupture of the membranes, but spontaneous abortion only happens in about 1 in 500 procedures. This is obviously much less than the risk of an abnormality being found. The procedure is done between the 15th and 18th week of pregnancy, so we could do it as soon as 2 weeks from today. Do you have any questions? And Mrs. White says, "I've read about these problems in some magazine articles. Now I understand a little better what they're talking about. Everything looks okay today, though." Yes, everything looks perfectly normal today, but congenital abnormalities can never be detected by physical examination at this stage of pregnancy. I've been very uncomfortable with termination, I believe you called it. I can appreciate that. Actually, even without considering abortion, you probably want to have the test. If the fetus would show distress during labor, and those with chromosomal abnormalities often do, our attitudes toward a cesarean section for the sake of that baby might be influenced if we knew that the fetus had a significant abnormality. Mrs. White, I see what you mean. Well, we could have the test done in 2 weeks then? That's right. We would meet in the ultrasound room, get a look at the fetus, and be able to guide the needle to a pocket of amniotic fluid without danger of hitting the fetus or the placenta. The only preparation you would need is to make sure you come with your bladder quite full. Mrs. White. Okay, I'll see you then. So, is your doctor telling you the truth? Both of those doctors are saying true facts. The message, I think, would be different. What I'd like to mostly get a response from you now about which of these doctors do you think is practicing in a way most appropriate or Christian, perhaps out of the Lutheran tradition? Should there be some sort of middle ground? Or what's your thought? Just give me some of your reflections upon which doctor you'd like to have.
Yeah. I think the second doctor seems quite a bit more subjective than the first one, and he is injecting some of his own personal opinion into it. And the first one just basically states some of the facts, I guess. Certainly doesn't have time to state them all. And then leaves the decision up to the patient, the basic decision to even have the test. And also the decision to ask more questions if she so wishes.
You stated at the beginning that she already knew she was over 35 and planned the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So she knew those risks. After the child was conceived, it's not the time to make the decision on whether or not she wants it.
I'd have to argue that not everyone who's over 35 and conceives is aware of the risks.
No, you said that was a planned pregnancy. She'd been pregnant before.
It was a planned pregnancy. In other words, it wasn't a mistake. But that doesn't mean she's researched the chromosomal abnormalities that are at risk. But she may well have, too. I mean, I'm not...
She did read something, I think you said, but she had done some reading, didn't she?
No, she'd done enough reading to avoid alcohol and that kind of thing early in the pregnancy thus far.
But not,
that's the
not
only thing we know about her.
Yeah. First doctor was a little bit more relaxed toward her situation. I think the second doctor is, I think, maybe pushing a little bit for her to be sure to have this procedure. The first one, like I say, he seems more relaxed. And puts more of the burden of choice on her. The second one seems to think she better have done what I did.
I guess as you were reading those stories, I was thinking within the framework of Christianity, if the physician was a Christian or the patient was a Christian, if you went ahead with amniocentesis, what are the implications of that? Are there implications for abortion, both for the physician and for the patient? And what does that mean within our Christian context?
Good question.
I guess my reaction to it is that both physicians were pushing their own point of view. The first one, by not telling her as much as he knew about possible genetic abnormalities, and trying, in my view, to influence her decision against amniocentesis. The second one, doing the opposite, telling her all the facts and encouraging her, really, to have the procedure done. I guess I would prefer a doctor who would tell me all the facts and let me make the decision based on my value system and not his.
Mm-hmm.
Cynthia, I noticed the difference in the descriptions of symptoms of Down syndrome. One thing, there are some mild symptoms that didn't go into the problems later in life or problems with the birth or congenital problems. And the descriptions of the facial features and stuff, you really injected a lot of that,
mm-hmm.
which was a major difference.
I think it would help a lot if doctors could advertise whether or not they're Christians before even going to be examined. Because then the two of you could sit down and discuss it from a Christian point of view.
Which
because you do tend to lean on your doctor and his opinion about things you have to do for help.
Sure. Do you think either of these doctors, let's put it this way, is one presenting a more Christian view than another?
I thought number one was, because number two is showing that by knowing how the fetus is, that abortion would be an alternative. I personally don't feel it is, unless it endangers the mother's health.
That's
I heard they both advocated, they didn't advocate, but they both stated that the test came back positive for choice of termination. That was the only thing that was said on both of them, except on the second one, when she questioned about, in the follow-up questioning, and came up with the possibility of knowing that situation existed. So it seemed to me that there'd be some basic knowledge or purpose in the test just to know. But neither of them said that up front. What was mentioned was termination.
Well, the reason that that's mentioned, just to give you background, is because that's the only reason to do the test that early in pregnancy. You could do the same test at 35 weeks gestation, at almost zero risk for the baby, essentially zero risk, and you could still have the same information. But you're talking to the lady now at 12 to 15 weeks only because your termination would be one action that someone might choose to take in response to this. There was a comment from the... Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I think both doctors, there could be problems with both of their attitudes. The second one has been discussed. The first one, I would be suspicious of a doctor that maybe underplayed the risk of certain procedures or certain abnormalities also. Because you can have a doctor telling you, don't worry, everything's fine, and be falling apart inside. They can't know everything like that. But I also have real problems with the concept of making sure that this is a Christian doctor, as if doctors of other faiths don't have any interest in life, or as if all Christians are going to believe the same thing.
Also, I had a doctor do an amniocentesis on me without telling me any risk. And I wanted to talk to you about it because I was worried about it. I mean, I didn't even think of it. He told me no risk. He didn't. And I found out as the nurse was getting ready, she said, don't worry, he's done three of these before.
Pardon my job.
To you about my daughter. She's not in here. She's 12, and I think she's all right. But I don't know if she was, you know, it didn't work right. And it came back up with blood rather than fluid. But I wanted to know, and I don't care if it scared me to know. It scared me not to know.
Well, to reassure you, the blood almost for sure came from your uterus, not from the baby.
Our daughter had both her babies when she was past 35. She's going to be 40 this year, and she has a 2-year-old. And she chose to not have them, these tests, because she felt that if God was sending her down a single child, she wanted to have that child. She
Yeah, of course, you as a physician, I'm asking you folks about what you do in the physician's role.
Yes.
Because what the patient does, you know, I may have in relation to this issue, you may have somebody coming to you who happens to be Islamic or Hindu or agnostic or any other attitude about abortion, but you don't know that before you start your speech.
I thought the first doctor presented the facts and told her
the facts, and I would have gone along with him much more than the second one and talked him into it.
I might also, and I'm sure that you do have different situations with different educational levels of the patient, and that certainly has to play into what you would be explaining and into what detail that you go. I personally would want to be the patient of the second doctor who was giving me all those facts.
I don't think either one of them gave an objective viewpoint. And he said, the first one, when I listened to it, I was inclined to think it was an objective viewpoint. Yeah, listening to the second was that came out obviously advocating for the test. When you compare the two, the first one was downplaying all the risks of not having it. So I think they were both advocating the view. As far as where the doctor should come from, I think the doctor should bend over backwards to objectively present both sides and say that the decision is yours, and I'll give you my opinion or recommendation if you want it at the end and at the conclusion. And then let the, because that's your job. You can't buck that job of making a recommendation. But having said that, I'm going to say the point's been made of being a Christian doctor. Coming down to being your recommendation, you have to give a scientific medical recommendation, not a theological one. And maybe those two things don't go together. Maybe we can't justify those up here at Holy Ghost. But from the practical view of a doctor, I think it would be virtually impossible for a doctor to give a personal theological opinion, ignoring the medical evidence, and practice on a day-to-day basis, merely from the malpractice and liability exposure.
Sure. Let me come back to you on that, though, and say, in this case, how can I recommend something?
Well, if you can't.
I mean, if there's
a
risk.
Lay all the facts out, and then if you say, I have no recommendation here, you can go either way.
Sure.
I think you can do that. It's down the middle. I don't think you have to make a recommendation one way or the other each time. I think there's black and white cases where you have a recommendation.
Sure. On the other hand, I mean, I've never been in a position where I can recommend things to people, but I've offended patients by telling them that the choice is theirs. And the particular patient I have in mind said, well, that's not true. I came here for your opinion, and you need to tell me what to do. It's not my decision. It's yours.
Well, I'm not saying you're going to be along with your patients all the time.
Well, no, I'm not talking about, I got along with her well. It's just that some patients
demand
that you make the recommendation. You know, some patients fit into these roles differently, and you as a physician have to figure out which one they are. And I agree with you. I mean, I think you should lay out all the facts and be as objective as possible and let them make the decision, but some patients don't want that.
She'd already had two healthy pregnancies, and everything seemed to be going okay. What about the one time in 500 that the healthy baby was aborted because of his test? That's something you'd have to face, too.
Mm-hmm. Certainly is.
I think sometimes when you go to a doctor like that, and they present you with all the facts, which is good from their point of view, I mean, you know those. But when you're emotionally involved and it's a baby and you want it, and suddenly you're asked to make this decision, and even though you have a week or so to think about it, it just takes you by surprise, and sometimes all the facts have just kind of gone over your head.
That's right. It'd be interesting to sort of pass a quiz sheet around here, and since you've heard it twice, find out how much facts were retained by everyone. Because the fact of the matter is when exactly what you said, if you're emotionally involved, the patient that walks out the door, you can ask her what you said and just get scared to death about what they heard. You know, a patient can come out the door and say, I'm not going back to him. He said I have to have an abortion because you mentioned the word. If you were like physician number one, wait a minute, that's not what I said. But you're right, there are certainly those issues of what's being heard in addition to what you're saying.
Well, in this particular case, you presented one thing that a doctor might say. Do you tell this person to do not?
But isn't it true that in most of the instances, when you're talking about laying out the facts, it would just be virtually impossible or even foolhardy to lay out all of the facts? Some woman brings a small child to you, and it's sick, and you know the beginning symptoms could either be this is just a flu, or it could be something much more serious. You just have to keep an eye on the child before you can find out. Now, at that point, you tell the mother, yes, well, this could be just a flu, or it could be whatever.
Spinal meningitis.
And you could just present a whole series of... And my mother is a nurse, has been a nurse for many years, mostly in infant and child care. And from what she's seen, she said that if women knew everything that could go wrong, that maybe some of them would be scared away from getting pregnant and having a child. And how much of that do you think?
Well, the fact of the matter is very few people present for pre-pregnancy counseling, so you don't even get a chance to scare them. However, you have hundreds of people coming in and say, I'm scared of the birth control pill, I'm not going to take it. But your mortality rate during pregnancy is only about 100 times that of taking birth control pill for 9 months. So there, you're right. As far as the risk-benefit ratio of pregnancy is rarely discussed.
Have there been cases where they have had the test and found out that there could be the possibility or that there is the possibility of the Down syndrome and they chose to not have the abortion?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. There are a large body of people, not the majority, but a large body of people who, after hearing this speech, say, I want to know. Mostly for the sake of, most of the time I'm going to be reassured and I can get this scare off my back that you just dumped me with. Okay? So a lot of people choose to have the test just to know the baby's normal and feel good, but they never would accept abortion as an option. And so there are certainly many, many people who act that way.
Is it helpful for the doctor to know this time?
Well, there's another ethical question for you, which physician number two brought out. The physician number two implied that if you knew the baby had Down syndrome and the kid had terrible fetal distress and labor, which would not be very unusual, you might not do a crash cesarean section, operate on this woman for the sake of that baby. Or you might. But yes, on occasion, the facts might taint your decision-making later. Is that good?
Does that mean that if they don't do a cesarean, the baby's unviable?
Well, that there'd be a higher risk of it. That the reason you do a C-section is for the sake of the baby, and yet because of what you might know about the baby, you might be more reticent to do the C-section. That would be really the other direct application of the knowledge. How does everybody feel about that? Well, you've had your arm up for a long time.
Very uncomfortable. I mean, it sounds like you're depriving that child of medical care that just because the child is developmentally disabled in some way, it wouldn't provide the care. Mm-hmm. That somehow doesn't fit right.
Of course, in this case, you're imparting risk upon another person for the sake of care. Which isn't the same as not caring for a baby who's born, but you're imparting risk to another person for the sake of this baby, which does make it a little more cloudy.
With a C-section?
Yeah. Mortality is clearly higher, although minuscule, when cesarean section is clearly higher than a vaginal delivery. Yeah.
Yes. If the there's some discussion about abortion, and you said the test, the only reason for having the test is essentially positive and then whether or not there's going to be an abortion. If I understand that.
Well, that's the only reason
Christian
you do it that early in the pregnancy. The
Christian response is, and I'm not taking a position on this, but from a doctor's perspective, is in his personal theological position is anti-abortion, then that doctor ethically not advise the patient at all. Stop and say you have a healthy pregnancy. See,
How does the group feel about that? Everybody hear that? Okay. The question was, if the physician had a clearly pro-life position, would it be ethically sound for that physician to say nothing? Say, see you in a month.
No.
Fairly resounding no. Now the other issue is legally, there is no question about it, because you will be strung up from the yardarm if you don't. But
yeah, you know, separate too.
Sure, that's what I wanted to get that answer first, but it is a moot question from the practicing physician's point of view. Okay, yeah.
I was wondering about second opinions. What do doctors think about them?
Most good doctors would consider it a bit of a waste of money, but certainly not harmful. In general, I mean, insurance companies that demand a second opinion in every case, that kind of thing, mostly it's going to end up being a waste of money. That's sort of a different issue. But you got to be really strongly motivated to disagree with your colleague who sat with this patient for, you know, 3 weeks and decided they need something, and then you got to get a second opinion, and this guy overnight is going to say no, or this woman's going to say, no, I don't think so. That takes a lot of guts, being the physician that walked in off the street. You're not going to do that very often. So mostly it's a waste of money, but that's sort of a different issue. Yeah.
My bias is against me trying to choose it.
That's okay.
Because I'm a critical care nurse, and I don't think most people can decipher what is, quote unquote, a good physician who would make an accurate diagnosis and bad physician, for lack of a better term, whose accuracy in diagnosis leaves much to be desired. So perhaps in that respect, it does get people away from bad physician to a better diagnostician in terms of treatment. Because I've seen a lot of people go to surgery that didn't need it, or that messed up in process, that if they would have had a second opinion, perhaps that wouldn't happen.
Sure.
I mean, there's both sides of that.
Sure.
I'm not sure that a lot of people can sort out what the good physician was, the bad physician was, inside the medical community or
the
healthcare system.
Yeah. Well, that is sort of a different topic and worth discussing, I agree, but I kind of like to game us back at this little difficult one we're dealing with at the moment.
Is there a possibility that if the amniotic tissue was sending, if the baby was found to have Down syndrome, that if the baby had difficulty during labor, and you had a clear pro-life stance, and the mother also had that stance, that you may do some more kind of interventions that you wouldn't normally do if you didn't know that child may have, for instance, a congenital heart defect. And yes, you need to get that baby out now to save that life. And not knowing that, you may think a normal, healthy baby could tolerate that.
Yeah, you bring up, which is probably true. I think the question boils down to, if you knew this baby had Down syndrome, that's one if. The second if, you and the patient were in agreement that no matter what, it's full bore for this kid, okay? Then you know this kid probably has a rather short little array of congenital heart defects, which is why it's having problems in labor. It's not going to tolerate as much in terms of difficulties in labor as the next normal baby does, which would give you a shorter fuse toward doing a cesarean section than it would in a normal baby who you didn't suspect some kind of cardiac problem. That's probably true. An interesting other way to look at having the knowledge.
We always hesitate to ask, what is this going to cost, doctor? What are we talking about in the hospital typical bill, possibly, and a procedural cost for this?
For the genetic amniocentesis itself? Fair question. It's expensive. Ultrasound probably is about $60. The procedure of getting the fluid off is probably, depending on where you live, Minnesota is 150 or so. Chromosome lab to grow the stuff, 300. So we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $500. Put it in California, triple it. So it is not cheap.
Now, is that the total expense? That includes doctor's fee too?
I think I tried to include doctor's fee in on that too. That was the 150 procedure cost.
And how about the hospital?
It often and most time is done in the physician's office.
Oh, okay. So.
How many of those conditions could be treatable medically? Just spina bifida or whatever?
Almost none. As far as prenatal treatment of disease, there are very limited numbers of conditions that we can do anything for. An obstetrician's current situation, now, in the 10 years from now, may be different. But currently, we have two strategies. Very rare occasions, you can drain off an enlarging cyst or something and save the function of an organ. Your other strategy is to deliver early and get the kid out to where somebody can do something about it if you think it's critical. And of course, you've got to always be balancing then how far along they are versus how bad the conditions get. And then if it's an option for you, then termination is the only other strategy available as an action after prenatal diagnosis.
Could it be said that there's some value in the reducing the shock value or the crisis for the parents in knowing that before the delivery date?
Some people feel that. Is it worth the risk of 1 in 500 of having an abortion of a normal baby? I don't know. That's certainly not why the test was developed.
I don't want to complicate this a little more. Let's ask Roger a couple questions first. These two physicians would not be atypical, correct?
Right.
I mean,
right. I could tell you two people on our staff that would approach the problems like physician one and physician two.
Okay. And how much time would you estimate that the office visit and that being with that patient took in this role model here?
Well, because you talk about a lot more normal things than we talked about in this paragraph, it would be impossible to do the exam, et cetera, in under 45 minutes.
And how much time do you usually spend with the patient in this setting?
We're usually allowed about 30.
See, Roger is, to my mind, I know him very well, and he's a very respected and cherished mentor and friend. And I know how much he cares about his patients. You can see the time crunch that he's under. And I think about physicians who are maybe less obsessive than Roger in caring for their patients. And you wonder what kind of care people are getting. You know, and you wonder how much in the back of the physician's mind, on the other side of him, you wonder what things are pushing him to tell you the things he tells you or to act in the way that he does. If he's having a bad day, maybe the same guy might give you the same.
Right. Okay. Well,
the question was, I'm allowed 30 minutes or 3 minutes?
Well, let's put it this way. If you want to not have your next patient be late, you're allowed 30 minutes. Now, you can take as much time as you want to and try to cram the rest of them into the rest of the day and have them yell at you when you're 2 hours late at the end of the day. But that's what happens usually. And that's why people sit in waiting rooms for 2 hours in doctor's offices, because you're slated for the normal patient, not for the one that comes up with something unusual.
How many of these tests are administered because of fear of lawsuits? There was an article about this not very long ago. I'm curious.
Okay. I doubt. Well, it's hard to quantitate that question. The question was how many of these are done strictly because of medical legal fears. I think that obviously the number has to have increased because many general practice people or other people would not have even mentioned it until it became a medical legal issue. I mean, until it became clearly cut down in the courts that you have to tell a woman over 35 that genetic amniocentesis is available, or you are essentially set up for a wrongful life suit, I'm sure that 30 to 40% of the women having babies around the country didn't hear about this over age 35. But now it's 100%, so that has to have increased it. But a physician, I would say, is just as much under legal scrutiny to push somebody into it and have a loss of the baby as a result of the amniocentesis as you are from telling somebody not to do it and having a baby with Down syndrome that didn't get detected. So I don't think how you present it is really much affected by the legal environment. The fact that you've got to present it is.
Yeah. So it's law over 35, did I?
It's not the law, it's a civil suit that you will, if you have a mother, it's court precedent. A woman who is over 35 when she has the baby, if baby has Down syndrome, you didn't tell her about genetic amniocentesis, you pay for that kid's institutionalization until it's 21. Okay?
Why are doctors pressured to overschedule?
Money. You want a frank answer? Well, there's a lot of need, certainly, also. But, you know, there's an economics to medicine, too. And we can't deny that that's a pressure that's playing on your physician and other physicians also, and everybody, that you leave great big holes in your schedule anticipating some kind of major problem, and you don't get any major problems, and you're paying your nurses and your office help, et cetera, with nobody coming in for help. So, I mean, also you got to provide for services.
Why does the doctor feel that his time is more valuable than maybe the patient? I mean, you get to sit in the office for 2 hours. I mean, that's
kind of weird. Yeah. Well, that's a sad situation. That's all. I agree with you. Okay, yeah.
Would the doctors be happy to delegate this decision-making process, this obligation, to someone else? If you have a question on their participants and the ethical decisions that I have in my class where doctors are coming from, they don't want anybody meddling in their affairs. But it seemed to me that what you'd want to do is after 30 minutes to lay out the facts and say we got these counselors at this board. They'll help you muddle through the decision making process. I'm on my next patient. I'm sure the bias is, you know, from a doctor's and individual perspective, he probably doesn't want that at all. Fight for it.
It's hard
to protect that, but it would seem it's method and I know it's one of the things you have up there, participants and ethical decisions, and aspects of an ethical decision. I mean, somebody at an esteemed institution like Pierpont, they can set up a whole department.
Sure. And believe it or not, I don't think that you get a whole lot of resistance on something that's cut and dry like this. You know, if you had some other trained ethicist who walked in and gave a speech to all your mothers who were over 35 that day and sort of glom them all into one, I don't know if it'd be better care. But we'd all say, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. But seriously, we think that, you know, probably sitting down with somebody who you're going to have a relationship with over the next 9 months, 10 months, is a better situation than abrogating that to another body. But they might be more well-trained. Yes?
Because people don't remember too well when they're under stress. You know, they go home and I've forgotten. What about having something blessed by AMA or such that there's a two-page summary of what you have told them, giving two copies to the patient, one which is to be returned next time, signed that I do or I don't want it. Seems to me that would take you off the spot or have the written information to look at, and you would have explained it to them.
Sure. Well, we do have the written information to give to the patient after this discussion so that she can then review it. But there's no doubt that the impression that the physician gave taints the reading of that also. Well, okay.
My sister-in-law recently went through this. Unfortunately, got a healthy baby. But because of her past medical history, the doctor did push.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting close to wind-up time. I guess I have a couple things for you to mull over through the evening. First of all, patient, let's imagine, and this doesn't have to be imagined, because the last patient that I had who chose to have a genetic amniocentesis, baby didn't have Down syndrome. It didn't have trisomy 13 or 18. It had something called Klinefelter syndrome. Klinefelter syndrome is an extra X chromosome, a male baby that has an extra X chromosome. This child was, all Klinefelters have about an IQ of 90 overall. However, it's only represents by about a fourth, well, more like an eighth to a tenth of them are handicapped significantly mentally, and the rest of them are pretty much normal. So it comes out in the wash with an IQ of about 90. And the child would be sterile, have a few sort of unicoid tendencies from a physical point of view, but nothing real problem, and a little testosterone wouldn't fix at the time of puberty. And the couple chose abortion. Those are sort of the information you didn't want to get on your genetic amniocentesis. And just also to sort of focus in your thoughts about this over supper, etc., is that no matter what age you are, if you decide to get pregnant and your obstetrical care provider is up to snuff, they will be asking you if you want to have a blood test called an alpha-fetoprotein test. And this alpha-fetoprotein test is a simple blood test, no risk to the mother, no risk to the baby at all, to detect neural tube defects, anencephaly, and spina bifida. And the risk is only 1 in 1,000, but the risk of the test is 0. It's an 80% accurate test at detecting anencephaly, which is a terrible malformation incompatible with life, and 80% effective at detecting spina bifida, which is a much more variable presentation in terms of how the baby would be handicapped. But every mother that comes into our office has to make that decision. Does she want to have that blood test done at 16 weeks or not? So this isn't something that's only for over 35-year-olds. This issue now is one of just a simple blood test. Do you want to have the blood test or don't you want to have the blood test? And everybody has to make it. So that how the physician presents it to you, it's difficult to be human and not color the way that you present the facts somewhat with how you feel about the issue. But I think those of you who felt uncomfortable with both physicians, I hope were right. Because I thought physician number one didn't lay out enough facts. And physician number two laid the facts out fine, but presented it as you should have an amniocentesis, and then went from there for building up the argument. That was that person's major error. To me, there's some place in between I'm comfortable with. But be aware, as you hear these facts, that you might hear them in a completely different way from a different position. Any other final questions or comments? Thanks for your attention.
Thank you.